Hello and welcome to Press TV's News Analysis. Coming to you from Tehran, I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, time for the British to pay. This is according to some Palestinians regarding London's role in the formation of Israel in 1948. Now, the UK-based Palestinian Return Center said that London should apologize for its role in creating Israel. And the Palestinian resistance group Hamas has gone beyond apologies and say that the British must compensate for its role in facilitating Israel, which has caused millions of people to be uprooted, property confiscated, and lives lost. On this news analysis, we'll be taking a look at the British role in the creation of Israel and what it means for millions of Palestinians even today.
Britain, it's time to apologize. That's the title of a campaign launched by the London-based Palestinian Return Center, or PRC. The group has called the creation of Israel a historic mistake by Britain and is blaming the British government for the decades-long suffering of the Palestinians. The PRC says the ordeal of the Palestinian people began after the UK approved the Balfour Declaration back in 1917. Hamas has also demanded compensation from Britain for the property Palestinians lost after they were forced from their homeland. The demand comes on November the 2nd, on the 95th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. The declaration was named after former British Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour, who had urged the British government to help give Jews a homeland in Palestine. Since its onset, the Israeli regime has created many troubles for both Palestinians and regional nations. Tel Aviv has forced millions of Palestinians to leave their homeland and settle at refugee camps in other countries, generation after generation. Israel has also made conditions intolerable for the Palestinians living in their homeland. It's been seizing more and more of their territory since 1946. These maps show the gradual usurpation of Palestinian lands. Israel has been building settlements on the lands it grabs from the Palestinians. It has also built hundreds of checkpoints in the occupied West Bank, making life difficult for the Palestinians there. The situation in the Gaza Strip is even worse. Israel has imposed an all-out siege on the Gaza Strip since 5 years ago. It also attacks Gaza from the air and ground almost on a daily basis. But Israel's crimes are not limited to these. Tel Aviv has massacred many Palestinians both at home and at refugee camps abroad. As for regional nations, the Israeli regime has launched several bloody wars against them, and it still threatens to attack others if, quote, necessary. The regime is also said to have stockpiled hundreds of nuclear warheads. The United States and other Western governments have turned a blind eye to Israel's repeated violations of international law. Washington, Tel Aviv's main ally, has time and again protected the Israeli regime at international venues. It has vetoed many anti-Israeli resolutions at the UN Security Council and the UN Human Rights Council.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, Mr. Muhammad Abu Saada from Gaza, Professor Gaza Al-Azhar University. Sami Habib from the Palestine Telegraph, out of London, and Allison Weir from Sacramento, California, president of the Council for the National Interest. Thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate all of you being with us. Let's start it off, though, in Gaza itself. Now, Mr. Abu Saada, do you think that London should actually be held responsible for the creation of the Israeli entity?
It is responsible. When Britain granted the Jews the right to establish a national home for the Jews on historic Palestine on November 2nd of 1917, Britain did not own Palestine at that time. Actually, Britain, it was still, World War I was still going at that time, and Britain was in no way in control or in possession of Palestine to give it as a national home for the Jews. And from there, the Palestinian catastrophe just went on, starting from 1917, Britain legalized the Jewish immigration into Palestine and land transfer from the Palestinians to Jewish hands, all the way until 1948, when Britain basically washed its hands of the Palestinian issue, decided to withdraw its troops from historic Palestine, and left the Palestinians to face their own problems with the terrorist Zionist groups who basically attacked Palestinian people at that time. And as a result of the war of 1948, more than two-thirds of the Palestinians were expelled from their homes and their territory. So basically, the beginning of the story dates back to November 2nd, 1917, when Britain granted the Jews a national home on historic Palestine.
All right, well, let me turn to Mr. Habib in London. Now, the Palestinian Return Centers say that they want an apology from London for the creation of Israel. However, with its continued unconditional support for Israel, the UK doesn't really appear to think that it has done anything wrong. Your take on this?
Well, I guess what is new in this case is what just happened less than 2 weeks ago, in which the tribes, the Mau Mau tribes of Kenya, have won some legal cases against the British government, in which they would be compensated for the damages and the losses they had in the 50s when Britain was colonizing their country. Britain would be compensating them. And this is a legal proceeding, I guess, for the Palestinians. And this is the principle where I believe the Palestinian organizations in the UK now are moving. There is a legal proceeding in which Britain now is being condemned by its court, and they have to compensate these victims. So the Palestinians have a chance now, not only just to hold the slogans and to claim that Britain is responsible for their mayhem and calamities, but also they have a chance to fight their battle in the courts. And I guess the British court system is very independent, and they have a great chance to win cases against what Britain and its legacy
has done against the Palestinians. Mr. Habib, with all due respect, I understand what you're saying about the Mau Mau in Kenya, but do you think the situation with Israel is somewhat different and the political sensitivity is extremely high, especially in the UK?
Well, I guess if we look on the Israeli lobby in the UK, it is very strong. We have the British Israeli Committee, the BICOM. They have very strong ties with the politicians. Most of the Conservative Member of Parliament are members within the Friends of Israel. And also many of the Labour Party members are friends of the Labour Party, Labour Friends of Israel. We have most of the newspapers, the journalists are really loyal in their discourse to Israel. But when I said the quote, I meant it because I believe, and there were some incidents in which the British court was really giving justice for example, what happened with Sheikh Raed Salah, in which the Israeli lobby and the British government were complicit in what happened to him, but the British court managed to do something against him. I guess we can take it from there as Palestinians, and there is a tiny chance to do it, although, as I said, the lobby is very strong and they would fight strongly and bitterly against this.
All right, let me turn to California and get Ms. Weir in this. Now, do you think that since the creation of Israel that it has been guilty of committing war crimes? And if you do believe that it has been, should the UK then be held responsible for supporting war criminals and enabling Tel Aviv to continue to ignore international law?
Well, certainly there's no doubt that Israel has been guilty of war crimes from early on through to the present time. So that part has been well documented by numerous human rights organizations and legal entities have documented that part. In terms of the British responsibility, especially regarding the Balfour Declaration, there is a very, very important backstory to this that is probably one of the most covered up aspects of this very covered up issue. The fact is that it came out in a book a few years ago and in a few articles by Professor William Rubinstein, who is a very well-regarded Jewish British historian. He's a member of the Historical Society, the Royal Historical Society. He was president of the Jewish Historical Society of England. And he wrote that the true author of the Balfour Declaration was not Mr. Balfour. It was actually a man named Leopold Amory, who was, in fact, a Zionist and a British man of Jewish background. As Rubenstein wrote in his book and in his article that was published in History Today, he called this the most remarkable example of concealment in 20th century British history. Amory not only wrote the Balfour Declaration, he later took credit for it. Most of this has not been mentioned by many people. As I say, it's enormously covered up. But there's a quote in which he said that, quote, "I seem to have had my finger in the pie, not only of the Balfour Declaration, but of the genesis of the present Israeli army." This is important information, what's going on behind the scenes now. Many of us know, certainly here in the United States, the power of the Israel lobby is extremely significant and pervasive. This goes back for many decades. Now we've learned through this excellent research by Mr. Rubenstein that the Balfour Declaration itself was written by a Zionist, and it was pushed in, as you said earlier, this was in 1917. It was negotiated in 1916. Well, in 1916, Britain was in the middle of what we now call World War I, what was then called the Great War. They were in danger of losing that war. In 1916, the British lost approximately 100,000 soldiers in one day in the Battle of the Somme. In just one day, in one battle, they lost 100,000 people. They were desperate. The Zionists came to them with a promise that if they passed a resolution in which they would support the Zionist push for a, quote, home in Palestine, that they would get the Americans to come in on the side of Britain in World War I. Okay. And this has then been referred to by a number of officials.
All right, well, let me turn to Mr. Abu Said. There's some interesting information that our guest in Sacramento has just talked about. I want to look at the Balfour Declaration. Now, Ms. Weir has said that basically it was because so many British troops had been killed, and basically they were sort of held on the gun and promised that if they agreed to this, agreed to give this land to the Israelis in Palestine, that the Americans would come in on this. I wanted to actually get to that and ask you, with the Balfour Declaration, what was behind it that these entities would agree to just give land away in someone else's country to a people that didn't belong there?
Now, the information which were mentioned by your guest, Allison, it's definitely very important and significant information, which basically is clarifying more and more about the causes of the issuing of the Balfour Declaration back in 1917 when Britain was in the middle of World War I. But let me just also alert you here to the point that that wasn't the first imperial exploitation of the Palestinian or of the Jewish cause. We all remember that back in 1798, when Napoleon invaded countries in the Middle East, Egypt and Palestine and Syria, Napoleon back in 1798, he also tried to exploit the Jewish cause. And he tried to basically get the support of the Jewish people in Palestine and in Europe to support his campaign on Palestine and the Middle East. So over the past 200 years, imperial powers, starting from France, Britain, and then later on the United States, tried to exploit the Jewish cause to basically plant a country, which is now Israel, which is separating the Arab countries between Asia and Africa, and also keeping the Arabs divided as they are right now. So basically, the existence of Israel fulfills the interest of the imperial powers, from as I mentioned, from France, later on Britain, who issued the Balfour Declaration. And since the end of World War II and the start of the Cold War, the United States, who became the world hegemon power, exploited the existence of Israel for its own interest to preserve and to protect its interest in the Middle East through Israel, as Israel became the military arm of the United States
okay.
in this region.
Mr. Abu Saeed, stay with me. I want to turn back to Sacramento because Ms. Allison Weir is definitely shaking her head in disagreement with your statements. Why is that the case?
Well, I can understand the statement, and certainly there's a great deal of culpability to go around. Britain and the U.S. are very responsible in horrifying ways for what is going on and for the tragedy. But in reality, again, I've done a great deal of research into this aspect of it over the last 12 years. And the fact is, as we found with Britain and then in the United States, when you research what was actually going on, you find that the State Department, the Pentagon, diplomats in the United States were consistently saying that supporting Zionism would be very damaging to United States interests, that it would not only violate basic principles that most Americans, I think, believe in, but that it would damage the U.S. We had the U.S. had very good relations in the Arab world. There was no reason to support this tiny movement that was, for many years, extremely insignificant.
So what happened, Ms.
There
Weir?
Were diplomatic cables that were saying that. What happened is that in the United States, as in Britain, the top rung of government are the elected officials. Elected officials have one goal that they all share, no matter what party they're from. They all want to be reelected. To get reelected, they need campaign donations for them, and they need to prevent campaign donations to go against them. What we've consistently found in the United States back from over 60 years ago through today is that campaign donations will come in on the side of candidates who promise to support Zionism and support Israel, and they will be opposed to candidates who say that they will not support Zionism. So from the very beginning, Harry Truman said to his experts in the State Department, who were saying, do not sacrifice U.S. interests just for the cause of an election. He said, gentlemen, I have 100,000 voters eager for the State of Israel. I do not have 100,000 Arabs among my voters.
So are you
That's
saying there
the
has been, a, let me just jump in here.
U.S.
Has there been
since.
A Zionist takeover of your country?
That's a stronger way than I would phrase it. But there has, but U.S. policies have consistently been dominated by the Zionist discourse,
okay.
by these this very powerful lobby. And if you go to our website, you'll see the kind, I'm talking about millions and millions and millions of dollars among dozens of organizations that dominate Washington, D.C. when it comes to policies in the Middle East.
Okay, well, let me turn back to London and get Mr. Habib.
And it's
Habib
been going on for a long time.
Okay, Mr. Habib, back in on this. Same question, but a different take, because you're sitting in London. How strong is the Zionist influence in the United Kingdom?
Well, we should be frankly speaking about this. I guess it's very strong. And there was an attempt from Peter Auburn of Channel 4 to speak about the Israel lobby, in which he released a documentary 3 years ago called Dispatches, about the Israeli lobby. We have seen within this Dispatches, which was the first movie, how the Israeli movie was very strong. Then there was a pamphlet that was detailing what the Israeli lobby. It is very strong. For example, the head of the BICOM can go to the Guardian chief and tell him you crossed the red line when the Guardian speaks and say Israel is like apartheid. This BICOM leader, the Israeli Zionist person, can go to the Guardian and tell him you crossed the red line. I guess this shows how strong is the lobby. In addition to the political side of it, we have the Labour Friends of Israel. We have the Conservative Friends of Israel. They are very strong. Even the Lib Dems, who were speaking about a two-state solution supporting the Palestinians, their discourse was affected when they have entwined with the government and entered the government with the Tories. Add to this, we have the newspapers here, the discourse of the newspaper, the Daily Mail, the Telegraph, and most of the right-wing newspapers. The discourse is totally adoptive of the Israeli narrative, except those newspapers like the Independent or the Guardian. in which the coverage is less conservative and more liberal towards what is happening in Palestine. And I believe the media is the core issue here, where the British public is really still ignorant of what is happening in Palestine. We have the Mughal, British Murdoch, Murdoch and his empire of the media outlets, in which he's really doing what Israel wants exactly. And Israel has not to worry a lot about its lobby. It's very strong here. And I believe it's as strong as the one in the US. We have the Palestinians on the other side still need some years and years to reach what the Israelis have done so far.
All right, let me turn back to Gaza. Mr. Abu Saada, I mean, both our guests in London and Sacramento talked about the strength of the Israeli lobby, the Zionist lobby. It seems as if the Zionists are extremely organized and put a lot of money towards their efforts. Let's look at the other side of the coin. There are others that are saying that why aren't the other entities more organized? Why aren't they trying to counter with giving money? For example, in the United States, in the UK, there are so many others who are actually against the Zionists, and yet they seem not to be able to get organized to try to counter the power of the Zionists. Why is that the case?
Well, this is a very valid and very significant question. Actually, when you look at the numbers, there are around 7 million Jews who live in the United States, but there are around 20 million Muslims who also live in the United States. But the power of those 7 million Jews are much more significant than the power of the Muslim community in the U.S. The Jewish lobby controls capital, controls the media in the U.S., or at least they influence much of the U.S. media when it comes to the Arab-Israeli conflict. Now, why the Arabs or the Muslim community, they are not united to counter the influence of the Jewish lobby? That is a question need to be addressed. But to the best of my knowledge, that Arabs and Muslims in the U.S. are divided, and they cannot agree on a one single issue. And that basically leaves more room for the Jewish lobby to influence U.S. policy, especially toward the Palestine-Israel conflict, and which basically gives more support for Israel.
Okay.
Look, for example, what happened just last month when there was a poster at the New York subway, when there was a big poster basically saying when there is a war between the civilized person and the savage person, support the civilized person against the savage jihadist. Support Israel against the jihadists. This
okay.
is the kind of incitement by the Jewish lobby in the U.S. against Muslims and Arab, and that's why it this is a very influential and powerful lobby in the U.S.
Okay, Mr. Abu Saada, I'm almost out of time,
US
but Ms. Weir, Ms. Allison Weir, you were disagreeing once again, nodding in disagreement. Your take on the same question.
Actually, in this case, I think there's a great deal of agreement. I think the numbers might, my understanding is that there are, I think there are only about 6 or 7 million Muslims in the United States, but I may be incorrect in that. But certainly, I agree with much of what was said. The fact is, though, the reason that I think it's very difficult for Arabs and Muslims and for others of us to oppose this very powerful Israel lobby in the United States is that when you come in late and without as much money, it's much more difficult. We're coming into a game that is somewhat fixed. They've been working on this issue for a great many, many years. And just one individual, let me give you one example. We have Sheldon Adelson, who's a very strong Zionist, a very strong supporter of Israel, who has said that he may donate as much as $100 million in this single presidential campaign. That's one person. There's Haim Saban, who donates. Adelson donates to the Republicans mostly. Haim Saban is an Israeli American who donates a huge amount of money, millions
okay,
of dollars.
Okay, I'm
to the
so
Democrats.
Sorry, but I have to give
so
30
it's
seconds
very
at
difficult.
Least. I'm so sorry. We're out of time. Just about Mr. Habib. 30 seconds. Do you see that there is a possibility that we could reach a point where actually the country that you're sitting in the UA could actually reach that point where not only would they apologize, but also perhaps could be give compensation to the Palestinians for their involvement?
Well, frankly, it's a bit hard to expect this. On the long term, it might happen. It needs, at the end of the day, a counter lobby of the Israeli lobby, a stronger lobby in which the money of the Gulf millionaire is not invested everywhere in the world without a target. And we will see, for example, if, as Alison said, if one Arab millionaire will use $100 million dollars in one of the British campaigns or the U.S. campaign, I guess we will have some counterbalance.
Okay,
or,
and on that note,
Israeli
I am
lobby.
So sorry,
and
but
by then we will
out of
have
time.
Something.
I appreciate all my guests for being with us, Mr. Muhammad Abu Saada from Gaza, Mr. Sami Habib from London, and Ms. Alison Weir from Sacramento. Thank you all for being with us. Thank you, viewers, for staying with us. We're out of time. Thanks so much for staying with Press TV.